Welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show on Renegade Talk Radio with your host, Dr. Carol. Though you may not realize that the ongoing threat of terrorism is affecting your life and that of your loved ones. Each week, Dr. Carol analyzes the hottest topics in terror and helps you and your family reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror.
Terror attacks multiply like rabbits. Welcome to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist and a psychiatrist. I'm here to talk about the things that are the top stories in terrorism for the week. And this week, there are so many. Actually, I guess you'd have to say that's a little more than a week. These past 10 days, there has been more than usual in terms of terror attacks and counter-terror attacks. And you will hear what I mean by counterattacks as we continue in the show. Now, first I'm going to mention Notre Dame, just to mention, because I did the whole show last week about Notre Dame. And by the way, no, I have still not given up the ghost of thinking that, yes, indeed, it was a terror attack. I would recommend that you go to the previous show about Notre Dame to hear all the reasons why I still think that indeed it is a terror attack, but that we may well not ever know that because there are so many political reasons why the so-called authorities would not want it to ever come out that it was a terror attack. Mainly because, as I've said, it would start a second French Revolution because of the climate in Paris, in particular, but in France, where most French people, are fed up with all of the immigrants coming into the country. And if it turned out that it was, in fact, a radical Muslim, particularly if it was an immigrant, radical Muslim, that would really get the country to be more chaos than it already is with the gilets jaunes, the yellow vests. Now, today, they're actually, the investigators were finally able to enter Notre Dame to start investigating the fire because they weren't able to do it before because the structure wasn't stable enough to allow people to go in and to start, you know, going to all of the areas where they need to look and to start trying to collect clues. Now, as you know, there are three different agencies that are in there looking for clues. I hope these agencies at least... You know, with three different agencies, there's more of a chance that it'll be objective. But again, it depends on who's paying the agencies and who they are exactly and whether they're from someplace other than France. I mean, I know there were, like the FBI, and there were different agencies also sent in to help. But we'll have to see who's doing what. In any case, as you know, there have been a number of reasons that causes of the fire that have been theorized, such as an electrical short circuit, a computer glitch, and a still burning cigarette that was tossed. Now, as well as others, all kinds, anything. And by the way, any of the possibilities that have been put out as reasons for why the fire started, any of them could have been perpetrated by a terrorist. And particularly, you know, my favorite, if you listened to the show last time, you know my favorite, and that is that it was a worker from Le Bras Frères, the company who is doing the renovations and the scaffolding and so on. And now it turns out, dun, 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 that some of the workers for this company have admitted to the police that they sometimes smoked cigarettes, despite the fact that this was banned. Now, of course, the company is denying that, they can't help that some of the workers already said that they smoke cigarettes, but they are denying that the fire was started by a cigarette. Now, there's no way for them to know that. There's no way for them to know it wasn't one of their workers. As I talked about in the previous show, there are a lot of times immigrants do get into this kind of workman sort of job, and that is my best bet for what happened, and it wasn't an accident. So I will go on past Notre Dame now to talk about the other attacks that have been spawned since then. Now, of course, you know the big one is the Sri Lanka attack on Easter. Now, again, the Notre Dame attack was at the beginning of Holy Week. It was April 15th into the 16th. And then on Easter, April 21st, was the Sri Lanka attack. Another coincidence, right? Now, the Sri Lanka attack, I'm not going to go into some of the, too much of the facts, because why spoil it with facts? No, I'm not going to go into too many of the facts that you will already probably know. But there are some interesting things that I would like to talk about. First of all, as you probably know, the attack was on, it was a coordinated attack on three churches during Easter services, when, of course, the churches would be filled, and three luxury hotels. There are varying accounts of how many were killed, anywhere from 253 to 395, and including at least 42 foreigners. And there are at least 500 who are injured. They have decided so far that there were seven suicide bombers. They were all Sri Lankan citizens and associated with the local militant Islamist group, NTJ. Now, there is a whole question still about the foreign ties. ISIS has tried to claim responsibility, but it is unclear just whether this is true. There are suspected foreign ties in this group of the suicide bombers and in this group NTJ, but it's not clear whether really, you know, it's not clear whether how much ISIS, if at all, was involved in the planning or, you know, the teaching of how to build these bombs and so on. But certainly it is believed that ISIS was an inspiration for what happened. Now, the prior attacks by this militant Islamist group, NTJ, were on Buddhists. So they don't have a history of having attacked churches. First, the news came out saying that this Sri Lanka attack was in retaliation for the New Zealand attack on the mosques. But then it turned out that they have discovered that this attack has been in the works for years. Before they planned it, way before the New Zealand attack. Perhaps it's been in the works for as long as 7 or 8 years. But you have to ask, why did they pick Easter Sunday? Now, of course, the most obvious is that's when the most people would be in the churches, either that or Christmas. But also, you know, was it related to the New Zealand attack on a mosque, or was it related to the Notre Dame possible attack? Also, of course, you know, ISIS likes to pick particular significant dates, and so Easter would be that, just like the Notre Dame incident fire, let's call it, which I'll try not to say attack, although that, you know, I still think of that way. But the Notre Dame fire was a day after Palm Sunday and the beginning of Holy Week. So again, that would be a typical reason for ISIS to pick that date. Now, the Sri Lanka attack, one of the interesting things is that there was a warning from India 10 days before this attack. India interrogated a suspected ISIS recruit, and this recruit told them that this attack was planned. And someone from India told the police chief in Sri Lanka, who supposedly sent an advisory 10 days before the attack to security officials. But somehow it got lost in the translation and never got to the senior politicians. And I'll tell you why this is all very, very, very suspicious. Stay tuned. When we come back, I'll talk more about Sri Lanka, why it's suspicious, who the masterminds were, and then talk to you about some things that have happened since then. Welcome back. Today, we're talking about terror attacks multiplying like rabbits. And in particular, I'm going to be talking about not only terror attacks, but the counter attacks that they have spawned. And all of this has been happening since April 15th, if you want to count Notre Dame, and up until actually yesterday. So there is a whole sort of frenzy of terror attacks and counter attacks. I was talking to you about the Sri Lanka attack. And one of the things that is so fascinating is that the masterminds of this attack are two brothers, and they were amongst the seven suicide bombers. They each were suicide bombers. And one of them, Ilham Ahmed Ibrahim, set off a bomb at the Cinnamon Grand Hotel. But now he actually had been arrested and released in the past. And his brother, Imsaf Ahmed Ibrahim, was also a suicide bomber. They do not fit the typical profile of a terrorist suicide bomber. Their father is a spice tycoon, a very wealthy spice merchant. And so they were very wealthy as well. And they were educated outside of Sri Lanka. They were wealthy, they were well educated abroad, and yet there are pictures of them in high society. You would think they had a very wonderful life and that they would be the last people to perpetrate a terror attack. Be a suicide bomber, in other words, die in the terror attack, rather than continuing their life, which was a privileged life. So it just shows to go you that even people who are wealthy, well-educated abroad, and seemingly have everything to live for, can fall victim to terrorist propaganda. Now, one thing that I'm interested in pursuing is finding out where they were educated abroad. That's so far what all the reports are saying. Because a lot of times, people who come from Middle Eastern countries who later go on to become terrorists and were educated in the U.S., part of their reason for becoming terrorists, part of their hatred for the U.S., I should say, and therefore a reason for becoming terrorists, is because of how they were treated when they were going to school in the U.S. A lot of times, these people were found prejudice. They ran into other students who treated them badly, who, you know, mocked them, who, you know, were prejudiced against them, Islamophobia and so on, and didn't, or even just excluded them. Maybe they didn't, you know, they weren't violent to them in all cases, but they might have bullied them, they might have excluded them. And all in all, they did not have a very positive experience going to school here. Then they go back to their country, or they stay here, but oftentimes they go back to their country, and then, yeah, they get, they're easily, they receive the propaganda of terrorists easily and see that as a way to get back at those people who had bullied them, excluded them, and so on when they were going to school here. Now, I don't know yet about where, I'm not saying that the masterminds of Sri Lanka went to school in the U.S. I don't know where they went to school other than it was abroad. It wasn't Sri Lanka. But, you know, that is not something to take lightly. It is something that should tell American students, and not just students, but, you know, tell us as Americans, and I know this is listened not just by Americans, but tell Americans to treat foreigners, all foreigners, better. And because they're, you know, not just because there can be consequences later on, they become terrorists, but just in general, because it's the right thing to do. So now the father, Mohammed Yusuf Ibrahim, is being held in jail on aiding and abetting and possibly conspiracy to commit a terrorist act. Also, the rest of the Ibrahim family are being held in jail, plus over 70 suspects who are all Muslim. There are four women there, and most of these suspects are friends or family of the Ibrahims. And it turned out that the brothers were building, they had a factory in which they were building these bombs, and no one suspected them. And, you know, of course, like the one brother who was arrested and released, clearly his wealth and position played a role in their releasing him. It's not clear what they had arrested him for, but surely his status helped to get him released. And like most terror attacks, many of these people who are now in jail, and certainly many of the suicide bombers who are now dead, were under surveillance in the past, but they weren't arrested. So what is really, really sad about this, besides the hundreds of people killed and injured, really a huge terror attack, besides, you know, the sheer numbers and you know, the three churches and three hotels and all of that, it's the fact that it could have been stopped. This could have been stopped. If, in fact, they had not just done surveillance, and of course, this is the way it is with so many terror attacks. I mean, the Orlando nightclub bomber, for example, he was under surveillance for a while and they dropped that. Lots of terror attacks. The person or people who perpetrated the attack were under surveillance. And there now, I mean, the problem now is that there are so many potential terrorists that there really aren't enough people to surveil them all. And so there's, you know, this whole issue of why the message didn't get transmitted to the people on the top, the senior politicians who could have made, you know, made changes to, you know, put the country on lockdown, arrested the people who were under surveillance. They could have done a number of things to prevent the attacks, or at least prevent some of them. And yet, because it didn't get all the way to where it had to go, that didn't happen. And I suspect, again, this is my opinion, but I suspect that this wealthy spice merchant family were able to bribe people on this train of, you know, like telephone, like, you know, this, the message getting from one person to the other from India and getting lost in Sri Lanka. I would not be surprised if bribery played a role. And that this message was, in other words, that the message was purposely lost. Well, when we come back, I will talk about these, what I'm calling counter-terror attacks. spawned by the Notre Dame fire and the Sri Lanka attack. This is really interesting stuff, because the point is that each attack spawns future attacks, not necessarily as big, and what I'm going to tell you about, you know, aren't huge attacks, and you may well not have heard about them, but they were in my opinion, in response to Notre Dame and Sri Lanka. So when we come back, we'll talk about the Sunnyvale, Northern California ramming attack on April 23rd. And on April 23rd over to 24th, an attack, well, a wannabe attack of the Austin Muslim Community Center. And this is what I mean by counterattacks. They weren't terrorists who perpetrated these attacks, but quite the opposite, in response to the terror attacks perpetrated by real terrorists. So stay tuned. Today we're talking about terror attacks that multiply like rabbits and spawn counterattacks. And just humor me by understanding that I'm still calling the Notre Dame fire a terror attack. That was April 15th and 16th. Then the Sri Lanka attack on Easter, April 21st. And now I'm going to talk to you about an attack on April 23rd in Sunnyvale, which is in Northern California, a car ramming attack, which of course at first seemed like perhaps it was a terror attack, a lone wolf terror attack, but in fact, it turned out to be the opposite. Now, in this ramming attack, a man named Isaiah Peoples, 34 years old, took his car, a black Toyota, and, you know, rammed into pedestrians on the street. He did not brake. It was clearly, there were lots of witnesses. It was clearly meant to be a ramming attack. He meant to run over these pedestrians. He injured 8 people, and then he crashed his car, or his car crashed, into a tree. It's unclear whether he did that on purpose or not. Probably not, because he probably would have gone on to try to hit more people, but his car ended up in a tree. And he injured 8 people. He actually was in the army, and he was in the Iraq War. He was in the army from at least part of the time was 2005 to 2006. During those years, he was in Afghanistan. He was also in Iraq. He described what he did as, quote, he wrote this on social media, quote, brainstormed and planned details of the daily missions and with the commander, the daily missions with the commander. So he was obviously trained in in brainstorming and planning attacks of missions. So he, you know, was able to plan, although it doesn't really seem like he spent a lot of time in planning it. That's the thing with ramming attacks. You can kind of have an impulse and then do it. Now, there are two things that are really sad and fascinating about Isaiah Peoples. One, that he apparently had PTSD from his time in the war, the Iraq War. And two, that he was raised quite religious. Now, I'll start with that, his childhood, because he was the son of a Christian pastor to start with. And I'll tell you some more things about why this seems to have been a counterattack to the Sri Lanka attack. In other words, and he had mental illness. And so in other words, this Sri Lanka attack of churches on Easter Sunday threw him off kilter, threw his mental illness, presumably PTSD, off kilter, and perhaps got him to stop taking his meds or whatever, activated his symptoms activated his psychosis and caused him to retaliate in this way. Yes, does it not make sense in a way that he ran over pedestrians? These weren't terrorists who he ran over, but it was, you know, much of what we know about him and his mental illness, his PTSD, does not make sense. But the point is that he was angry that Christians were attacked. And this is what he did. This is what his, perhaps, voice is. This is what his illness told him to do. He wanted to retaliate in some way. So his brother describes him, describes Isaiah as a kind-hearted Christian churchgoer. As I said, this the son of a Christian pastor. They were raised very religiously. And he, at the crash scene, after he was running down pedestrians and then crashed into a tree, he was heard by witnesses saying, praising Jesus. He's saying praised Jesus, repeating that, and also repeatedly mumbling, Jesus, I love you. He also praised Elijah. You know, this is kind of the counterattack to Allahu Akbar. He was very active. I mean, to this day, well, to the day that he got arrested after he rammed the pedestrians, he was active in his church. I'll tell you some other things about him. First of all, after the crash, he didn't try to run away. He laid face down, waiting for the cops to arrest him. Sometimes before this, sometimes his family would hear him say, in these bouts of psychosis, religious kinds of things, like just saying out to the world, out maybe to himself, to the voices he might have been hearing. He would say, I rebuke you, Satan. Satan, get out of here. Sometimes he felt like the government was bugging his house. That's actually a typical sign of schizophrenia. So his diagnosis has not been clearly reported, but mostly PTSD has been reported. He was also in his mother's house. He was also seen to be rocking in a corner. And then when she asked him about it, he would deny that anything was wrong. He's been in the hospital. His brother has given different reports, or the reporters have written different things. He's been in the hospital from months to a year. His brother said that in a lot of ways, though, he's normal, like, and it's just these bouts that would come about. Presumably, his brother did talk about when he would lapse in his medication, he would have these bouts his brother said bouts of PTSD. But otherwise, he liked movies, he liked exercise, he liked hanging out with friends and family. He doesn't drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes. As I said, he was active in the church. And he was not unintelligent or not uneducated. He went to college and he got a BA in accounting from UC Sacramento. And he has worked, and he was actually working up until this ramming attack. He, as an accountant, there have been different jobs. He worked as a business analyst pricing specialist. And then it seemed like at the time of the attack, he was working as a government contract auditor. And he told his mother that day, right before he went out to commit this ramming attack, he told his mother, he seemed upset. And his mother said that he seemed like troubled, like he was about to have another episode. And he told his mother that he was worried about his accounting job and he didn't want to do accounting anymore. But the company that he was working for said that he was still in good standing at the time of this attack. So right now he's facing 8 counts of attempted murder. Another little intriguing point. His car registration had been revoked because he paid with it with a he paid for it with a bad check. So, you know, a puzzlement, but clearly, in my opinion, and I know you might be thinking I have all these conspiracy theories, but sometimes conspiracy theories are actually conspiracies. But and of course, all of these things are terribly tragic and sad. I, as a psychiatrist, however, and the terrorist therapist, like to try to get to the bottom of it and try to understand what made people do what they did. So I definitely think that maybe unconsciously, I'm not saying that he was able to consciously put it together, I'm going to ram over pedestrians because the terrorists killed people in churches in Sri Lanka. I don't know that he was thinking of that consciously, but certainly in his disturbed mind, I do think that he that was at least an unconscious reaction to it. And my fourth example today of terror attacks multiplying like rabbits and spawning counterattacks, so to speak, is what happened overnight around midnight between April 23rd and 24th. And that is a man who whose identity has not yet been found as of this time. A man tried to commit arson on the Austin Muslim Community Center. He is seen on security video. You can find it on the internet. Hopefully somebody will see that and be able to recognize him. He went about this by pouring gas on the Muslim Community Center and lighting a paper and throwing the paper at the building. And even though he was there for 20 or 30 minutes, he wasn't able, this was not a very effective attempt, and he didn't set the building on fire or set anything on fire. But in the morning, there was a gas odor, and so they called the fire department, and that's how they found all of this. They found him, you know, saw the picture, they looked on the security cameras, and that's how they found, you know, the picture of the man and so on. So again, let's just say Notre Dame being attacked, Sri Lanka being attacked, both of those by terrorists again. Well, we know Sri Lanka was by terrorists. We don't know if it was ISIS or just the local group, but there probably was some help from outside, if only inspiration. And now a man with a severe mental illness responded to that by just acting out, basically, and committing a ramming attack, which is typical of terrorists, but he did it not being a terrorist. And then, of course, the man trying to hurt Muslims, because that's a little more clearly a factor, more clearly related. You know, you can see how that's related to anger about the terror attacks, the previous terror attacks of this month. So, bottom line, it's not just, you know, when one terror attack happens, that's not the end of it. There are more people who are likely to be inspired in a very twisted way and to hurt even more people than are killed and injured in the original attack. Thank you for listening to the Terrorist Therapist Show. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist.
If you would like to find out more about terrorism from me, your terrorist therapist, visit my website, terroristtherapist.com. And if you're a parent or teacher and want to build stronger nests for your kids to become more resilient, check out my new award-winning book, Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, Oh My, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror. It's the first and only book about terrorism for kids. You can find it wherever books are sold or directly from the publisher at terrorismforkids.com. Terrorism, the number 4, kids.com. I'm Dr. Carol, your terrorist therapist.
Thank you for listening to the Terrorist Therapist Show on Renegade Talk Radio with your host, Dr. Carol. We hope listening to the show has made you feel calmer, more resilient, and more able to reach your dreams despite living in a time of terror. You can also check out past shows on Renegade Talk Archives for more insights.